Well, first you should probably know the subject because we're changing tracks right now on the expressway. We have Dave Emery with us, and Dave has been doing political commentary and political research for years and years. How long have you been at this, Dave?
Well, I've been doing research for about 7 or 8 years now, and I've been on the air for a little over 5.
Okay, and you do a local public station around here, right?
Well, yeah, my broadcasts are, well, I'm involved with, I really should say, a total of 3 different stations. I began on a small listener-sponsored station in Cupertino called KKUP, mm-hmm. and eventually my program, which is, it's called Hard Rain on 2 stations and For the Record on KKUP. Same program, different title. It was picked up by the Cal Berkeley station, KALX, which plays it to this day. And eventually I got involved with KFJC, the Foothill College station, and my show is carried there. I also air the cassettes of a woman named Mae Brussel, who was sort of the dean of this particular type of research. And I'm also very much involved with a guest you had on some weeks ago, a fellow by the name of Nip Tuck, professionally that is. I work very closely with him, share research, and we do a combined archive show on KFJC called Radio Free America. So I'm involved with a total of 3 non-commercial stations here in the Bay Area, and generate a total of, I'm involved to one extent or another with a total of 10 broadcasts a week.
Now, how did you get involved with political commentary and research? What drove you to do this?
Well, during Watergate, I was on the East Coast and in a so-called underground or alternative newspaper. I saw an article which said that Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963, which, of course, was when President Kennedy was killed down there. And Kennedy ran against Nixon in 1960. And ever since, from that moment forward, I became very interested in the assassination of President Kennedy and suspected that there were probably some links between that and Watergate. And the more research that I did into the assassination of President Kennedy, the more it became obvious that the official version, which survives to this day, was not only wrong, it was certainly wrong. Lee Harvey Oswald not only did not act alone in killing President Kennedy, he did not act at all. He was demonstrably innocent, and the physical evidence points in this direction overwhelmingly. Beyond that, more significant is the fact that every major institution in our society to this day is continuing to propagate this lie, which is that this lone nut assassinated the president. And it seems to me that is even more important than the fact that Oswald didn't do it, which is the fact that all of our major institutions are putting forth a thesis which is not only wrong but blatantly incorrect. It's physically impossible. The Warren Commission's thesis was physically impossible in all of its major manifestations. There are links between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination, which we can go into if callers are so inclined. I don't want to begin ticking those off right now because it take quite a while. Furthermore, after a while, it became very clear that not only was the, well, I guess we could call it the national security establishment, meaning elements of the military and the intelligence community involved behind the assassination of President Kennedy, but that all of our assassinations and attempted assassinations, meaning the assassinations of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the attempted the shooting of George Wallace, all of these things are very much connected. And it seems to me that it represents something which deserves a lot more attention than it's gotten. It seems to me that it represents a fundamental compromise of the American way of life, in that as one book, a good book on the various assassination puts it, that instead of government of the people, by the people, for the people, we're having government by gunplay, which is the title of that book.
That's pretty disconcerting stuff, Dave.
Yeah, well, it is. The format that I use on the non-commercial stations I'm on, and which Nip Tuck has adopted very well to his program, is a little bit bizarre and a little bit pedantic in that we excerpt actual documentary sources at length on the air, and we encourage our listeners to tape them so that basically instead of accepting our word for these things, because obviously, you know, we're talking about something which is at a 90-degree variance from what most people are accustomed to thinking, what we do is we provide them with some of the documentation themselves so that they can stand on that, which presents a firmer base than us sitting here and rattling this stuff off the top of our head, plus they can examine it at greater length. Mm-hmm. And during the course of the broadcast tonight, as listeners call in and ask questions, one thing I'm going to be doing is citing books where possible, newspaper articles and so forth, not because I'm trying to show off how much I know or because I'm trying to appear cute or clever in any way, but again, when you're talking about things which are at a 90-degree variance with what people are accustomed to thinking about, you know, it's incumbent upon me or upon anyone who is basically assailing the established truth to document what they're saying. The burden of proof is on the critic, in other words, and that is... That consideration is foremost in the format I use, and it'll be in evidence tonight.
This could be real interesting, because Dave Emery has done a lot of research on what he's saying, and will back up a lot of his contentions with his studies over the years. And we do invite your calls here on the Expressway. Our number is 575-KOME. Let's go to the phones right now, Dave, if you're ready for it.
Sure.
Want to grab something?
Let's go. We're ready.
All right, here we go. Line number one, first of all. Good morning. You're on the Expressway.
Yes, hi. Dave, I was wondering, Mark David Chapman, the man who shot John Lennon, was a member of some organization, and I was wondering if you could talk about that organization a bit, and I was also interested in what sort of person George Bush is like, and what sort of things he might have done in his past that might be along your lines of research.
Okay, well, let's start with Mark David Chapman. Now, the only organization that I'm aware of that he was affiliated with is an organization called World Vision. Now, of course, jumping back for a second, Mark David Chapman is the fellow who was convicted of assassinating John Lennon in December of 1980. Now, one of the pictures which people may have seen, which came out of Chapman shortly after the assassination of Lennon, was one of him carrying some Southeast Asian refugees up on his shoulders, and there's another one of him out jogging in sweatsuits. This basically was taken at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, and these refugee camps, or the refugee camp for, I believe that was for Cuban refugees that had come over in the late 1970s when President Carter was president. That refugee camp was run by an organization called World Vision. Okay, now World Vision is something that people will see advertised on TV. It ostensibly is a missionary organization. In other words, it does charitable relief work. It represents itself as a Christian relief organization. Now, Christian Century magazine has maintained that, in fact, World Vision is a CIA front, and specifically that in Southeast Asia, it worked hand in glove with the U.S. Armed Forces and intelligence community in identifying the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese cadre and infrastructure in what at that time was known as South Vietnam. There have also been reports of World Vision being involved in El Salvador. Now, Mark David Chapman was involved with this organization, and or that is to say, he was involved with the Fort Chaffee Refugee Center, which was involved with World Vision. Now, this ties directly into George Bush, your second question, because one of the key figures in World Vision, I remember, Christian Century magazine has identified that as a CIA front. It is not, in fact, according to Christian Century, a legitimate Christian relief organization at all. Okay, now, and again, Mark David Chapman, the fellow who assassinated Lennon, or was convicted of assassinating Lennon, was a member of that organization. Now, one of the linchpins, one of the kingpins, I should say, in World Vision, is a fellow by the name of John W. Hinckley Sr. Okay, he is the father of John W. Hinckley Jr., who was convicted of shooting President Reagan and three other people, including Press Secretary Brady, in March of 1981. Now, John W. Hinckley Sr., in addition to being an official with World Vision, was also one of George Bush's largest contributors when George Bush was contesting Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination in 1980. In other words, John Hinckley Sr. Gave a lot of money to George Bush's primary presidential run. And it's interesting also that the night after President Reagan was shot, Neil Bush, George Bush's son, was scheduled to have dinner with Scott Hinckley, John Hinckley's older brother. They are, in fact, business partners. And this is interesting, of course, also because George Bush was a former director of Central Intelligence. And in my mind, the most significant thing about Bush's tenure as CIA director was the fact that he was CIA director when former Chilean ambassador to the United States, or former Chilean official Orlando Letelier, was killed by a bomb in Washington, D.C., and elements of U.S. intelligence were very much involved with that. So there hopefully is an answer to both questions and a bit of a connecting link between the two of them. The last thing I'd say in that regard is that John Hinckley Sr. was a Nazi, John Hinckley Jr., rather, was a Nazi. And, when a Nazi shoots the president and there are links to the vice president and former CIA director and nobody cares a thing about it, seems to me we got trouble.
Right. Okay, that's a pretty good answer. I would also like to know anything else you can say about George Bush, and I'll take it off the air.
Okay, thank you for your call. By the way, if you'd like to join our conversation with Dave Emery, our number is 575-KOME.
Something else about George Bush. Well, let's take a look at something which, quote, conspiracy theorists of the right point a good deal at, and something which I think deserves more attention, not necessarily in the light they've given it, but George Bush's membership in something called the Trilateral Commission. Now, the Trilateral Commission is basically an organization put together by top industrialists and political figures in Western Europe, Japan, and the United States, basically for regulating mutual political and economic policy among those three entities. Now, in the 1980 election, for example, on the Democratic ticket, you had Jimmy Carter, who was a former member of the Trilateral Commission, running for president on the Democratic ticket. Walter Mondale of the Trilateral Commission, who is now the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, running for vice president on the Democratic ticket. On the Republican ticket, you had Ronald Reagan running, backed by George Bush of the Trilateral Commission. And you also had an independent candidate named John Anderson, the alternative candidate from the Trilateral Commission. So it seems to me we have an organization which wields a great deal of power, David Rockefeller being very much involved with it. And although it's dangerous to seize on any given organization as being the locus of power politics and as being the generative force behind world events, it seems to me that, again, when we have one organization which is so heavily represented in the people running for the highest offices in the country, this also bears watching.
Well, now, Dave, your documentation's real interesting. You sound real well-researched, but, I mean, if George Bush was somehow involved in the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, why didn't he try again?
Well, we don't know necessarily that he either has or won't. I think in order to really find out sort of who the power behind the throne is, I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens, first of all, in the upcoming election, whether or not Reagan gets reelected. I think he certainly is going to. And then it'll be interesting to see whether he finishes out his second term. A lot of publicity has been given to the age factor and whether or not Ronald Reagan has the stamina to put up with another 4 years in a very difficult situation, namely the presidency. It may be that George Bush is sitting around waiting until he either resigns, or something else to think about is the fact that there are the so-called sleaze factor. There are a lot of scandals which the Reagan administration has so far been very successful in putting on the back burner. In particular, the Ray Donovan scandal could really explode because that involves, among other things, at least three murders, a disappearance of another person, and some of the same people who crop up in the background of the Donovan case have also cropped up in the background of, among other things, the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa.
Now, Donovan is the Secretary of Labor, right?
Secretary of Labor and also the first cabinet member ever to be indicted, and it remains to be seen how far that scandal is going to unravel. There are other scandals within the Reagan administration, and if any of them mushrooms too much, we could see a Watergate-type situation where Reagan is basically forced out by scandal.
Okay, we're talking with political commentator and researcher and conspiracy theorist. May I call you a conspiracy theorist?
You can call me. It's not a term I particularly like, because usually I'm not theorizing. In other words, if people ask me an opinion, then I wind up dealing with theory. But I like to stick to the documentation. But
okay.
It'll do for the time being.
Okay.
I prefer the term researcher, and people ask me what I am. Well, I'm a political researcher, and
okay.
Let it go at that.
All right, we were talking to Dave Emery. I'm Larry Johnson, your Expressway host. Our number is 575-KOME, and let's go to those phones right now. Good morning. You're on the Expressway.
Hi, my name's Kevin. I was just curious about the extent of the George Bush involvement, and I was wondering if you really like rock and roll, and I like Billy Squire.
Okay. You want to take that over the air? Fine. Okay.
Well, now, the first part was about George Bush. He wanted to know just how involved George Bush was. Well, I guess that depends on what he's involved with. Now, the fact, let's go back to the fact that he was a former director of the CIA. I think we can assume that anybody who makes it to be director of Central Intelligence does not automatically sever their intelligence connections. You don't become director of something like the CIA and then just walk out the door and sever all your connections with it because you know too much. You know literally where all the bodies are buried, and you know a lot of things which simply leave you in something of an insider's position. So it seems to me axiomatic that George Bush has to have connections to the intelligence community to this date, which raises some questions about a man who is a heartbeat away from the presidency and who is of necessity, and again, I don't think we're making too great an assumption here, must still have connections to CIA, and yet he's in a position to become president of the United States. Again, it seems to me the question of what role the intelligence community is to play in our democratic system of government is brought to the fore here. Do we want the CIA, in essence, in the Oval Office, or at least more in the Oval Office than they've been to this date? And as far as rock and roll, I listen mostly to jazz and blues.
You covered all the bases there. Okay, we're talking with Dave Emery. If you'd like to join our political discussion, the number 575-KOME. Let's go to line number 2. Good morning. You're on the air.
Howdy. There's something I've been hearing about for years in strange places, and I was just going to like throw out the main words at you and like see how you probably know what I'm talking about once I get started. There's people who talk about David Rockefeller and the International Monetary Fund and Trilateral Commission being in some sense set up of some sort of plan for world government, and has to do also with advances in counterfeiting technology. They're going to not have paper money anymore, and the idea is similar to universal product code. They're just supposed to install something in your wrist or your forehead, and like so everything is automatically debited and credited into your vast central banking account, and this is supposedly tied in. Now, this is the great thing. It's fantastically interesting, the weird stuff you hear, with the Mark of the Beast in the Book of Revelations. And I just wanted to hear what you'd say about this, and I'm sure you've heard the same thread of thought over your years of research.
Right. Well, that's exactly what I was alluding to when I said that the Trilateral Commission, of which David Rockefeller is the single most important member, and in many ways the generating force. And I alluded to the Trilateral Commission being a major object of discussion in right-wing conspiracy theories.
So the Council for Foreign Relations, too.
Right, exactly. Both organizations, both of them very much affiliated not only with the Rockefeller financial and industrial empire, but also very much affiliated with the, quote, Eastern establishment. In other words, with your old Eastern fortunes, your old Eastern, industrial and financial empires, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, and so forth.
What do you think of Lyndon H. LaRouche?
Well, let me answer your first question first, and then we'll get to Lyndon LaRouche, okay?
Okay.
Now, it seems to me the most important thing to take note of about the Trilateral Commission, again, is the concentration of power. The reason why I ticked off the connections between the 1980 presidential and vice presidential candidates and the Trilateral Commission is to give some indication of the degree of influence this organization can wield. It does have a great deal of influence, and when you examine the various components of the Rockefeller empire, just the Rockefellers alone wield a tremendous influence in this country by virtue of the concentration of ownership, the percentage of the wealth that has been concentrated in the hands of the Rockefellers and other industrialists and financiers who are closely affiliated with them, the DuPonts, Rockefellers, Morgans, DuPonts, Mellons, and so forth.
Right.
Now, the importance of the Trilateral Commission and its motives have been greatly distorted in a lot of far right-wing literature, and this is sort of what you're talking to, about and addressing yourself to. You made an allusion to the International Monetary Fund, and I think that should be perhaps separated from the Trilateral Commission for the purposes of the present discussion. That is an international regulatory body which has some connections with Trilateral Commission, but it's a little bit different.
Well, there is David Rockefeller running the Chase Manhattan Bank, I think it's called, and, you know, the International Monetary Fund is basically a tool of international bankers, right?
Well, it is a
it
is essentially, yeah, it is a vehicle for political control internationally by major international financiers, and David Rockefeller, or the Rockefellers, they own a controlling interest in the Chase Manhattan Bank, which is the largest commercial bank in the country. They also own a controlling interest in Citicorp, the second largest commercial bank in the country. And between them, Citicorp and Chase Manhattan own a controlling interest in the Bank of America, which is the fourth largest commercial bank.
No, that's interesting.
So this is the point in what I'm talking about in terms of concentration of power. Now, there are a lot of assertions about plots to upset the international monetary system and corrupt things by using paper money and so forth. I don't pay them a great deal of credence. And then, way, way off in another, a whole other spectrum of of analysis, it seems to me, are the charges about, you know, the beast of revelations causing everybody to have a number put on be it their wrist or their forehead or something. Basically, that's a lot of fertilizer. You know, spread that on your garden and it'll make it grow.
It's really interesting, though, you know. Like, a lot of strange people believe that stuff. You know?
Well, yeah, exactly. A lot of strange people do believe that kind of thing. I think it's important to stay away from that kind of stuff if you wish to be taken seriously. And it is interesting. One of the things that I would recommend to you, caller, would be to begin examining some of the more substantive research, which is just as interesting, and you can go a lot farther with it because it's based in fact, not in fantasy.
Gotcha. And, like, the one last quick question, what do you think about Lyndon H. LaRouche? Is it true he used to be a communist?
According to LaRouche's account, he is. He has... LaRouche is a strange fellow. He has a lot of money. Nobody seems to know where it comes from.
Now, let me tell you what I've heard about where it comes from. I've heard that, like, he was getting information from the CIA about drug deals in Latin America. He was, like, saying he's doing something to fight. And I've heard allegations that he gets money from selling cocaine.
There is a massive... All right, let's take it one at a time. LaRouche does have connections to various elements of the national security establishment. He has received information from and sat in consultation with people from both the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and wire service accounts in the newspapers over the past 6 to 8 months can confirm that. As far as his...
That's what I've heard, I thought I'd tell you, you know.
Oh, yeah, well, no, it's been verified, and as I say, in wire service stories carried in both the Chronicle and the Mercury, you can verify that. Now, as far as his money coming from drugs, I can't... I have no firm information on that at all. It is worth noting that, again, the intelligence agencies are very much involved with the drug trade. Basically, at the end of World War II, there were very powerful communist parties in both France and Italy. Now, one of the deals that the CIA and the National Security Establishment in this country made was basically to enlist the services both of the Union Corps, the Corsican Syndicate, and the Sicilian Mafia in putting down the very powerful communist movements in both Italy and France. Now, in exchange for this, the drug traffic, which was primarily the province of the Union Corps, the Corsican Syndicate, and they worked closely with the Sicilian Mafia in this, basically that was the safe passage of the drugs over across the Atlantic and into the United States was guaranteed. There was a trade-off. The federal government in this country used the Mafia and the Corsican Syndicate in order to put down communism in Europe, primarily in France and Italy. In exchange for that, safe passage for their drug traffic was guaranteed in this country. Now, this is, again, as I said before, I like to cite sources, because obviously that sounds like a really fantastic statement to make.
I've heard it before, though, yeah.
Well, two good books that you can look that up in, which you could find in the library, or perhaps go around, look in bookstores, look in used bookstores. One is a book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by a man named Alfred W. McCoy, M-C, capital C-O-Y. You can find that perhaps in libraries, used bookstores, and so forth. And another book, just a fantastic book, and this is a much more recent book called The Great Heroin Coup, published by a freelance Danish journalist named Henrik Kruger. And that's a soft cover edition published by the South End Press in Boston. And again, I'm citing these sources not to try and appear clever or because I'm trying to look cute, but because information like that, you know, it's basically a fact. It's a historical fact, and yet, because it's so different than what people are accustomed to thinking about, you know, people are inclined to... poo-poo that sort of thing. So again, those are a couple of good sources to check out in order to verify what I've said.
Well, it's been very interesting to talk to you. I've talked to you for a long time, but I'll get off the air. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks for your call too. We're talking with Dave Emery, political commentator and researcher here on the Expressway. Dave, what about Lyndon LaRouche? I mean, that was probably one of the most phone calls that the local station here got was when LaRouche magically popped up one day.
He's an interesting fellow. As I said, he has links to, not only to the national security establishment, but also to the paramilitary right. Lyndon LaRouche's people, notably one of his many organizations called the U.S. Labor Party, took paramilitary and mercenary training with a fellow by the name of Mitchell W. Werbel. Now, Werbel, who passed away last December, he was not only very much affiliated with the intelligence community and worked with the Phoenix program in South Vietnam, which was an assassination program aimed at eliminating the Viet Cong infrastructure in South Vietnam, but he is one of the darlings of the Soldier of Fortune crowd, one of the darlings of the mercenary crowd, and his Cobra training school in Powder Springs, Georgia, has received a great deal of publicity, and is one of these mercenary schools where people go to learn how to throw an axe and how to shoot a shotgun and so forth and get ready for race war Armageddon or what have you, depending on what pet philosophy you subscribe to.
Certainly was a change from Different Strokes and Three's Company that evening, wasn't it?
Well, he's an interesting fellow. As I say, most people people researching clandestine politics wonder where his money comes from, because he's extremely well financed, not only for the TV and radio spots, but his publications are extremely the stuff in them, it's a mixture. A lot of it is verifiable as true, a lot of it is verifiable as nonsense, and then most of it simply is intriguing but can't be verified one way or the other. I personally avoid his research for that reason. I can verify from my own work that some of what he says is true. On the other hand, he says things like the fact that the Democratic Party is run by the KGB.
Yeah,
and again, put that on your garden, that'll make it grow. But where the dividing line is between what LaRouche says that's valid and the obvious nonsense is anybody's guess, so I don't touch him. And the real rub with LaRouche is, where does his money come from? His publications are very well done, the glossy finish, and the photography's excellent, and there are a lot of bucks behind him. Nobody seems to know where those bucks come from.
Yeah, and a half hour of network television time doesn't come cheap either. We're talking with Dave Emery, a political commentator and researcher, and our number is 575-KOME. We've got a couple lines lit up, so let's go to those lines. Line number one, first of all, good morning. You're on the expressway.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you
doing? I've been sitting here listening, having a really good time listening to you guys talk. I think you're kind of getting off the subject and the track of the whole thing a little bit, because it seems to me it's nitpicking and about certain small issues in the past, and it's tough to deal with that. I mean, I know that. Basically, it's like the biggest, I think, this is all what I think, and I would say that to you right off the bat, is that the money, and like I'd tell you, and you know this too, is that the biggest company in the United States is the government, and the second is the mafia, and I think this is what happened recently, was the mafia bailed out the U.S. government, and Reagan's the total puppet we really feel in our hearts he is. And I really mean to say that, and I just want to, you know, I don't mean to be down at all or nitpicking in a negative way. It's just that I don't usually call up and tell you what I think, but...
Actually, we welcome your call.
Great, thanks a lot, you know.
Alrighty. Well, you said a number of different things. As far as what the biggest company in the United States is... one could, in fact, look on the government as a company. I really think that...
The IRS is, like the SS, so to speak. You know, if you remember anything about, you know, German and Hitler's, and it's right along the same lines, and you know it. You know, people that pay income taxes are totally ripped off, especially, like, I know for a fact that single white males, you know, I think is about 25 years old. Well, see, how many 25-year-olds can you name to me that have a successful corporation? The fingers on it, the thumb is on it, so heavy. And I notice that here, especially in, like with Bill Graham and stuff, you know, this. Back in New York.
Okay, I'll tell you what. Let Dave talk to that the mafia charge here for a second, if you would.
Okay, well, you brought up a lot of different things. Let me try and address myself to each as best I can here in the time we're going to have. I don't personally think it's useful to think of the government as a company. Rather, I think it's useful, at least as far as the American government is concerned, to regard it as the tool of a number of different companies that are really the multinational corporations, which are the dominant industrial and economic interest in the world, in the non-socialist world today. I think the economic component of our government is there. The tax structure, for example, is something you brought up, and a number of other different aspects of our federal regulatory structure do, in effect, promote certain other interests or further certain interests more than they do some others. Certainly the number of corporations in this country which got away with paying no taxes last year, I don't know what the number is off my hand, but it's significant. A large percentage of the Fortune 500 paid no taxes whatsoever in the fiscal year just concluded. That indicates that the tax structure, to use one aspect of the federal regulatory structure, can indeed be used to distribute power and wealth unevenly. The mafia itself, I think it, at this point it's a little bit risky to speak of the mafia because the Cosa Nostra, the Italian syndicate, is only one of a number of organized crime interests in this country today. Something which has received a lot of publicity in the past week and a half is the growing influence of various Asian organized crime syndicates in this country and in the West Coast in particular, and their participation in some corporations. Organized crime in general is very, very influential in this country, and it is a business just like any other. I think a few years ago there was an article in Fortune magazine which said that just the cocaine trade alone is something like the fourth or fifth most profitable industry in the United States. It was something like between General Motors and another very well-known corporation. And, of course, that is just one illegal drug, and a number of illegal drugs could be said to comprise the drug trade, which, again, is only one aspect of the vice industry as a whole.
Okay, we're talking with Dave Emery, a political researcher and commentator, and the number is 575-KOME. We have a very patient caller on line number two who I'd like to get on the air here, Dave, so let's check this person out. Good morning, you're on the expressway.
This is for Dave. Can you name any sources for your George Bush, John Hinckley allegations?
For my George Bush which?
John Hinckley.
Okay, yeah, as a matter of fact, the San Francisco Chronicle from April 1st, 1981, and as a matter of fact, you'll find that on page 2 of most editions. I've forgotten what the wire service credit was. That will document the role of John Hinckley Sr. in George Bush's primary campaign. It will also document the fact that Neil Bush, George's son, was going to have dinner with Scott Hinckley, John W. Hinckley's older brother, either the night of the shooting or the day afterward. But again, San Francisco Chronicle, April 1st, 1981.
Okay.
Page 2.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, thanks for your call. Now, Dave, I mean, really, if this is the conspiracy that we're led to believe here, why doesn't Reagan just dump Bush altogether? If I were Reagan, I wouldn't want somebody biting at my heels like that.
No, but if you had a gun at your head and you figured that the best way to survive was to play along rather than to get shot, that is one hypothesis. Again, I am not privy to the inner workings of the Oval Office. It's just that having studied this country's political assassinations and having studied to a certain extent bare-knuckle politics in general, it certainly the more power is at stake, the more people are going to be willing to do to get a hold of that power and to use it to their own advantage. One thing that I think is unfortunate about American political awareness, one might call it perhaps American political mythology, is the fact that Americans find it very easy to accept the notion that other countries, great and small, have political assassinations, that there are factions within the power structures of these countries which are rivals and which seek to supplant each other using various means, including violence. People perhaps have seen... there was an excellent series on public broadcasting in which you still see sometimes called I, Claudius, which is all about the machinations of the various Roman emperors and how they murdered each other and sought to elevate each other over each other's dead corpses into the throne of Rome. If you study the history of Europe, you'll find all sorts of plots and conspiracies in which people seek to dispatch each other in order to acquire the throne and all of the power that goes with it. And yet when Americans look at our own country, and I think most people in the audience will feel comfortable with the notion that this is the most powerful country in the world, and consequently somebody wielding power, somebody gaining control of the presidency, is in a position to wield more power than anyone. Yet when Americans look at our own history, for some reason, we're the only country that doesn't have politically motivated assassinations. Now, an examination of the facts blows that one right out of the water. We have, in fact, had political assassinations, and one interesting fact is that going back to the assassination of President Kennedy, for example, the only formal investigation, that is to say, the only investigation which ever resulted in the Kennedy assassination being tried in a court of law, was conducted by New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. Now, Jim Garrison indicted a number of people, including a fellow by the name of Clay Shaw. Now, the jury in the Garrison trial, when Clay Shaw was tried, something most people don't know, is that the jury concluded that there definitely had been a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Kennedy. It's just that they could not conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was involved. One of the main reasons why Jim Garrison was unable to obtain the conviction of Clay Shaw that he wanted was because three of his key witnesses who he sought in connection with the prosecution were not extradited, that his extradition requests were not granted. It'd be worth going into the history of these. First of all, there was a fellow by the name of Sergio Arcacha Smith, and he was in Texas, and John Connally, that's Governor John Connally, who was riding in Kennedy's motorcade and who was wounded in the fusillade, refused to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith to New Orleans. John Connally also, by the way, was the Secretary of Navy who subsequently downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge from the Marine Corps to dishonorable. Recall that Oswald had allegedly defected to the Soviet Union with top-secret information about our radar nets, and yet he was never prosecuted. Not that, but he received an honorable discharge from the Marine Corps. Eventually, though, John Connally, at that time Secretary of the Navy, downgraded it to dishonorable. That was one of the witnesses Garrison couldn't get a hold of. Second one was a fellow by the name of Gordon Novell. Now, the governor of Ohio, John Rhodes, agreed to extradite Gordon Novell to New Orleans on the condition that Garrison wouldn't ask him any questions about the Kennedy assassination, which, of course, is the thing that Garrison wanted to extradite him to New Orleans about. Okay? Very strange behavior. I think we can all agree. Now, the third witness, and this is why I brought it up at this time, was a fellow by the name of Edgar Eugene Bradley. According to a Dallas policeman named Roger Craig, he saw a man, either Oswald or somebody closely resembling him, leaving the back of the Texas School Book Depository. When he then stopped this person, a fellow came up, identified himself as a Secret Service agent, and he then was obliged to let the fellow go. And from subsequent photographs, he identified this guy as Edgar Eugene Bradley. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley was right here in California. Now, Garrison filed an extradition request to California. Then State Deputy Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien reviewed the extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Then Governor of California Ronald Reagan refused to grant that extradition request. He did not act upon it until after Richard Nixon was elected president, and then turned down the request without comment. And the fellow who handled the day-to-day machinations of the Edgar Eugene Bradley cover-up was Edwin Meese, then the legal counselor of Ronald Reagan. So perhaps Ronald Reagan knows something about the history of this country's political assassinations that would keep his mouth quiet. I realize that was kind of a lengthy answer, but this, in my opinion, it's worth giving some of the background to these things so people can begin to speculate for themselves. As I say, I'm not privy to Oval Office conversations.
And indeed, there's a lot of different facts that one has to put together, and it does take some time for exposition. Tell you what, we're going to do a little business here, and then we've got a couple lines lit up. We're talking with Dave Emery, a political commentator and political researcher. If you'd like to join our discussion this morning, do be a little patient. Our number is 575-KOME. We'll be back with Dave right after this.
This Wednesday night, a Halloween extravaganza. It's the Tubes in a full stage production, and the San Jose Civic will never be the same. The Tubes in a Halloween stage spectacle with a very special treat, Eddie and the Tide. And introducing San Francisco's The Works. What do you want? Wear a costume. Huge prizes for most erotic, exotic, and tubular categories. Supplied by Rock Fifth Avenue and Paramount Imports. You'll also have a chance to get lucky in the casino room and win big prizes. Tickets at Rock Fifth Avenue for The Tubes. Wednesday night, 7 p.m. at the San Jose Civic from KOME and Nelson Productions.
Now where's your ticket?
Here's another sensational special at the Super Shops Automotive Performance Centers in Santa Clara, Belmont, and Hayward. Get this. Urson High Performance Cams as low as $39.95. Right. Urson High Performance Cams for most cars as low as $39.95. $39.95 is an incredible price, so get it now at the Super Shop stores in Santa Clara, in Belmont, and in Hayward. Some of the top drag racers in the country use Urson cams and valve train components. Don Prudhomme, Kenny Bernstein, Shirley Muldowney all use Urson. Shouldn't you too? Especially for this low Super Shops price on the Urson Performance cam as low as $39.95.
Once before CAMCER.
Back now to the Expressway Show on KOME. Call us now and get in on the action. 575-KOME.
Our topic this morning is both an intriguing and most disturbing one. We're talking with Dave Emery about some of the news that you may not have heard. He's really well researched in his field about political assassinations and maybe some of the strings that are being pulled behind the scenes. Our number 575-KOME, if you'd like to talk with Dave. Let's go to line number 3 and see what one of our KOME listeners has to say about all this. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I hope you don't mind if I change the subject a bit, but I figured maybe you would know a bit about this information. I received in the mail not too long ago a thing about the 10% flat rate tax, and, I had been wondering about that. It sounds like a good idea, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
It's not something I've done a whole lot of research into. I basically feel that a graduated tax structure is the most equitable. Within a graduated tax structure, you can have an awful lot of loopholes, and therefore there's an awful lot of room for unfairness, for inequity of sorts. I basically am against a flat rate. I think that the only way that any halfway equitable situation is going to be established in this country with regard to the tax structure is to have a tax structure which does act to place a larger share of the burden on those who are best able to carry it. In other words, if you were to say that everybody was to carry the same amount of weight, that's not fair to a little old lady who may be carrying 100 pounds is not as easy for her. I'm against it personally. It's not a subject I know a great deal about. I think that the previous caller who brought up the subject of the Internal Revenue Service as basically an institution for the redistribution of wealth has hit upon a very important aspect. You know, with regard to the IRS, I think it does serve to make the powerful and the wealthy more powerful and more wealthy. I think that the flat rate tax will tend to do that, and I disagree with it.
Well, from the way I heard it, it was more or less that, you know, as it is, the wealthy are using so many tax shelters and deductions that and of course this 10% flat rate tax wouldn't there would still be the deductions. You would still have, of course, dependents and whatnot. So there would still be it would be 10% write off, and then there would be, of course, the reasonable deductions, and then I guess they would just get rid of all that other stuff to where the wealthy couldn't get away with as much and be able to not pay tax.
I haven't actually gone over the wording of the proposition myself. I'm skeptical. Most of the so-called tax reform that's come along in the past few years has actually served to make the tax structure less fair than it has been. I think Mr. Jarvis and his efforts in that regard are a good example. We all heard when Proposition 13 was going to be passing about what a great boon this was going to be to everybody, including renters. Well, the rents have been going up. Renters haven't been getting anything out of it, but maybe bent a little bit lower and reamed out a little bit more thoroughly. And I'm skeptical. You know, again, I don't consider myself an authority on it, but I guess with regard to the flat rate tax or any tax reform, I'd have to say I'm from Missouri and show me.
Okay, thanks for your call this morning. We're going to move on. We're talking with Dave Emery, a political commentator and researcher on KOME, our number 575-KOME. Let's go to line number 1. Good morning. You're on the air.